I love you, dude.
I love you, bro, Montana.
Today in Studio 360, describe Paul Rudd, the actor and his characters, in one word. Charming? Sweet? Goofy? Those all work, but ask him, and he goes with awkward.
I would say there's been a very awkward thread through a lot of the stuff that I've done recently, and that's because that's the way I feel many times throughout my day.
I love you, Holmes.
I love you, Broseph Quibbles.
And all those straight guys getting all warm and fuzzy in bromance comedies? Absolutely realistic, he says.
It's different saying it to a guy, but I've certainly told many of my male friends that I love them.
Plus, states doling out huge tax breaks to Hollywood. Is that party about over?
Once you start giving incentives, it's kind of like heroin addiction without the benefits.
That and more is ahead this hour in Studio 360, right after this.
You're listening to the podcast of Studio 360 from Public Radio International and WNYC, where each week Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. We have a great website, too. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion. Scion was started by a small team that was passionate about an idea for a different kind of car company. And now Scion wants to help others follow their passions. The Scion story is at scion.com. Scion, what moves you?
Billy Pilgrim could not sleep on his daughter's wedding night.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. John Ronson is a smart, funny British journalist who always wanted to be a writer, until the author of Slaughterhouse-Five almost convinced him otherwise.
Because he puts himself in his books, and he always portrays himself as quite miserable, I thought, God, I don't want to be a writer if that's your life. You're all alone in a room, chain smoking. That sounds like a terrible life.
The complicated influence of Kurt Vonnegut, later this hour. But first,
step this way!
A new movie about the Wizard of Oz, Oz the Great and Powerful, directed by Sam Raimi, comes out next spring.
Kansas is full of good men. I don't want to be a good man. I want to be a great one.
But like Dorothy said, they're not in Kansas anymore. This Oz was shot in Michigan. Oz the Great and Powerful was the high watermark of an ambitious program to convert some of the state's abandoned auto factories to film studios. State taxpayers funded more than 40% of the cost of filming the movie at Michigan Motion Picture Studios, a new facility in Pontiac outside Detroit. But the run at that brand new studio is already over. The new governor of Michigan wants to scrap all those generous tax breaks and incentives for filmmakers, and Hollywood, naturally, is taking its business elsewhere. Peter Deckham is a very prominent entertainment attorney in Hollywood. He also helped the state of New Mexico a few years ago create its film incentive program. Peter, welcome to Studio 360.
Thanks for having me here.
So during the last dozen years, most states in the union have started offering these programs of tax incentives to get movies and TV shows shot in their states. But as in Michigan, a lot of them aren't working out so well. Why is that?
Well, there are a whole bunch of reasons, and it really depends on the region itself. In the case of Michigan, they were exceptionally generous. They had the most generous program of any state. The problem with it is they were trying to jump into the world and establish something instantly, when in fact, when you don't have local crews and you don't have local infrastructure, all you're doing is incenting people from other jurisdictions to come and take advantage of your credits and then leave.
Even if you have a few features being made and a couple of TV shows, you don't necessarily instantly. It's not film industry in a can.
Pretty much correct. And once you start giving incentives, it's kind of like heroin addiction without the benefits.
Yeah.
You kind of have to keep going because the world is profoundly competitive in these various and sundry tax schemes. And in fact, the definition of mental illness in Hollywood is making a large budget motion picture without some kind of tax incentives, which we call euphemistically soft money. The average movie today is generating about 13% of its budget, net, from these soft money incentives.
If you're a citizen taxpayer of state X, Y, or Z whose state is doing these things, Should you be concerned that with all these states in the game, as they have been, some not wisely, that it has been a race to the bottom to pay as much as we can to get these movies here?
I think it's a very real concern if you're not building indigenous crews and infrastructure. And also the temptation of padding budgets so that you can get a bigger tax credit has taken down the Iowa film program, for example. There are actually people serving time in Iowa right now, based upon an egregious set of violations. So, yeah, the other thing I find absolutely fascinating is how many states think they can do it without accessing some level of expertise from the film industry.
Yeah.
They know better, and they create programs that have absolutely nothing in logic. Or they get unemployed actors who become champions of their cause, and the unemployed actors don't really have an understanding of the economics. They just want it.
And where has it not worked anywhere, or have some of these state programs worked better than others?
So when we started in New Mexico back in 2001, we had 1.7 crews. By the time I left the program about a year and a half, 2 years ago, we had 7 or 8 first-rate crews, which for a tiny state is pretty huge. And we had 2 massive infrastructure projects. For states like Louisiana, I believe that Republican or Democrat, if you mess with our tax credits on film, we will send the gators out to eat you. The debates come down on your metrics. How do you measure whether a program is successful? Ernst & Young did a study, and they came out with an analysis that said for every dollar that is spent in one of these programs, where you have indigenous crews, mm-hmm. not where you import crews,
mm-hmm.
you get $3 of expenditures that trickle through the economy. People pay rent, they buy groceries, they live there, pay their mortgage, etc. When you have people coming from outside the state, that type of benefit doesn't stick.
Right. It's just the circus coming to town.
That's right. They come in and they leave. So, you know, the key is to build a steady program where you actually have people live in your state permanently so that they become intimate parts of your economic infrastructure.
Jennifer Granholm, who used to be governor of Michigan when the program there got underway, and speaking to all of the problems she had, says, well, why can't we have a federal program instead of all these states competing against each other? Is that a workable idea?
Right now, you're not going to see anything from the federal government. Just not happening. But you notice that every major country in the world has co-production treaties with other countries where these tax benefits, which are federal, are shared with the other country, provided that you have enough people or infrastructure from each country to qualify.
Every time we see a movie where the credits before the movie roll and we see the British government agency did this, or the French or the Russians or whomever.
Yes, but the only country in the world that has no co-production treaties is the United States. Back when I was much younger, there was something called the Investment Tax Credit at a federal level, which allowed people who made motion pictures to claim a 10% credit against their federal income tax. That vaporized, and then various states stepped into the fore to do it.
There you go. Peter Deckham, thank you very much.
My pleasure. Bye-bye.
Peter Deckham is a prominent entertainment attorney in Hollywood. Whether you think it's a wise idea economically or not, what's been your experience when Hollywood comes to shoot a movie where you live? Let us know at studio360.org. This weekend, artists, dealers, collectors, and critics are all heading to Florida for Art Basel Miami, now the most significant and buzzy annual art fair in the country. Dozens of satellite events surround the fair, including one exhibit made up entirely of gifts. No, not gifts like Christmas presents. GIF, G-I-F. GIF stands for Graphics Interchange Format, those short digital animations of images on a loop, like digital flipbooks. They're all over the internet at this point.
It's shiny and it's flashy and it's relentless and it never stops moving.
They can be amusing briefly and then usually annoying.
I can't stop this feeling.
Like that dancing baby in a diaper, which was everywhere for a while. The Oxford English Dictionary just named GIF the word of the year, and Alicia Zuckerman says it's time to take these unserious little images seriously.
For Johnny Mischief, it all goes back to those dancing babies.
You know, those dancing baby GIFs, I feel like they were promoting like an insurance company or something, you know, and it was really weird. He's dancing around, kind of shaking his booty. Yeah, it's creepy.
That was in the late 90s. Now Mischief blogs for the New York Times and is an all-around man about the internet. And he's putting on a GIF festival. It's called Moving the Still.
Some people are going to be looking at some of the submissions for the show and think, what the heck? this isn't art. This isn't anything, you know. So hopefully the show can kind of elevate the GIF to the next level.
Social media is a big part of why GIFs are getting so much attention now, because they're so easy to share.
The GIF really needs that. You know, this is like such an era of wow me in the least amount of time that you possibly can, because I don't have time to like invest in your stuff. It's like the prove it to me generation. If you haven't roped somebody in within 2 seconds, then you lost, you know?
The festival is part curated and part open call. Thousands of submissions have poured in on the microblogging site Tumblr, and Mischief has seen them all.
If it sucks me in, then I can look at it for, you know, upwards of a minute, which, you know, internet time, that's like years.
I think the Moving the Still exhibit, it's all fitting in with the zeitgeist. This is, in some ways, the year of the GIF.
Art critic Carolina Miranda says GIFs are showing up everywhere. The Guardian newspaper posted a real-time stream of GIFs during the debates. And last week, a new Britney Spears video was promoted with a GIF.
I think what I personally love about a GIF is how lo-fi and crude it is.
One of the artists invited into the show is Alex DeCorte. He mostly works with physical objects out of his studio in Philadelphia. He'd never made a GIF before Mischief asked him to. He used techniques from vaudeville and cartoon animation to make a series depicting hands interacting with a candlestick and a purple rubber glove.
You know, you're looking at these gloved hands. The colors are kind of garish. It's a little funny. It seems like a nod to some of the works made by conceptual artists like Bruce Nauman in the 1970s who did video works that involved hands.
This festival is all about internet art. And the funny thing is, the internet plays almost no role in DeCorte's life.
I spend, you know, maybe less than an hour on the internet a week. I don't know. I get so bored. I'm like, I don't know what to do on here. There's nothing on there, you know.
What? That's crazy. That's nothing.
That's the conceptual artist, Joe Kay. He started his GIF with a photograph the artist Cindy Sherman took of herself.
The image itself is a fairly attractive woman kind of lounging on a bed. It looks definitely vintage and dated.
From there, he went for straight-up simplicity.
If you recognize that it's a Cindy Sherman photo, of course you have the expectation that it's going to move. And then subtly and quickly, she starts blinking at kind of an awkward pace.
The coolest thing I've ever seen.
Johnny Mischief is crazy about this GIF.
They're so stunning, and they're so subtle, and it just adds this life to these existing works.
But critic Carolina Miranda is not as impressed.
I thought that was cute, but how many times have I seen a GIF on the internet that involves someone blinking? Yesterday, I saw Picasso blinking. I've seen pictures of Frida Kahlo blinking.
The show is a hybrid. It brings together serious art and pop culture.
The festival kind of brought out this different type of GIF making than what we usually do at BuzzFeed. Some of the GIFs are very, like, way more art-driven and, like, performance-driven than I've seen on the internet so far.
Kritika Mallikarjuna created one of the most popular GIFs of the year with her colleague Chris Ritter. They made it for the website BuzzFeed. They were inspired by Beyoncé's Single Ladies video. It's called Sassy Obama.
The Sassy Obama, I think I saw it on Tumblr probably like no less than 36 times by different people who had shared the image. So it's basically Obama's head on this hand-drawn woman's body swaying sort of suggestively back and forth. And there's something about the movement and the smile on Obama's face that kind of says, hey, yeah, I did it, you know, like, back off.
For election night, Mallikarjuna was putting together a list of alternative jobs for Obama in case he lost.
And I thought to myself, he should definitely be a Beyoncé backup dancer, just because two immensely cool people that captivate like America's imagination should definitely be together in some kind of way.
She has a theory about why a GIF like this got so popular.
Weird internet is good internet.
The team behind Moving the Still wants to keep that weirdness And they also want some attention from the art world. Carolina Miranda thinks it's working.
It's nice to see a show like this in Miami during Art Basel and all of the other fairs, because you basically have every collector, every curator, every art writer descending on the city to see what's happening. And part of what's happening is the GIF. And it's nice to see digital art getting some show.
For Studio 360, I'm Alicia Zuckerman in Miami.
The Moving the Still Festival is part of Art Basel Miami, which is going on right now. You can find out how to see it online and see the GIFs from the story at studio360.org. Coming up, actor Paul Rudd. He's been in a lot of buddy movies, and when he's not in character, he has a real-life bromance with his producer and director, Judd Apatow.
We spent a lot of time together. He and Leslie and Julie, my wife and I, have sat in rooms for hours.
Leslie being his wife,
yes,
who plays
my wife.
Your wife in the movie.
Yes, it's all very...
Sweeney.
It's all one giant key party.
The 70s live on in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion. Scion was started by a small team that was passionate about an idea for a different kind of car company. And now Scion wants to help others follow their passions. The Scion story is at scion.com. Scion, what moves you?
Really, I'm a pretty nice guy. Just ask my parole officer. Apparently I'm not a funny guy.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. Ever since he played Phoebe's boyfriend on Friends about a decade ago, my two daughters have had a crush on Paul Rudd. My wife has a crush on Paul Rudd. I even sort of have a crush on Paul Rudd, which is probably why he's cast in so many romantic comedies and helped invent their new subset, bromantic comedies. He's got a new movie coming out at Christmas, Judd Apatow's This Is 40, but Paul Rudd has also consistently been a serious theater guy as well, and right now he's starring in the new play Grease. And right now he's starring in a new play.
And it's not so new. But I'm playing.
But you made it new.
Well, you know what? I feel like I don't want to toot my own horn, but I really feel like I reinvented Kinnicky.
It's Grace. It's called Grace, and it's on Broadway. Paul Rudd, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So in this play, your character is an evangelical Christian and entrepreneur who wants to start up a chain of Christian-themed motels. It is a dark and difficult drama, ultimately, and your character is not lovable. Was that what attracted you to it?
Well, initially, yeah. I mean, I liked the script. I liked the story. And I thought it was – and there were conventions in the play that I hadn't seen before, that I thought if this comes off the way I'm imagining it, it would be really interesting.
You mean the replaying
stuff like, like going backwards, repeating scenes in reverse, simultaneous action happening in two different places but overlapped on one stage. I thought it would be an inventive show. But in answer to your question about the character, yeah.
Playing against type?
A little bit. I hadn't really played a guy like this. I mean, I have played a guy like this, but in plays, never in a movie or anything.
You're a scientist. You're like an athlete of the mind. And that's great. You, with your great mind, you can compute things I can't even imagine. Probably most people can't. What a gift. My expertise, Sam, my gift that I've been given is faith. See, I'm not a knower. I'm a believer. And that's what the real estate market is all about. It's about faith.
Do non-comedy roles come your way and you just turn them down?
You know, occasionally, but I would like to do more dramatic stuff. I mean, this play is another example of that. I don't want to map it out like that where it's like, okay, I've just done a comedy. Now I'm going to really shake it up and play my serial killer role.
You do plays every few years. Is that sort of a schedule you're committed to?
It's not a schedule I commit to. Although, you know, growing up, I was never, you and I are talking, we're both kind of from the Midwest. I never went to the theater in the way that I know a lot of my friends that grew up in New York City.
You weren't a Glee theater?
I was not a Glee kid. I never, you know, saw Pippin at the age of five and said, I want to do that. And it wasn't until I was in college that I even started doing plays and really dramatic plays and
right.
And no, classical theater, you know.
When yeah. you look at, when I look at your biography, you grew up in Kansas City, you go to college 45 minutes away at the University of Kansas. That doesn't look like the biography of somebody who's got a bead on show business.
Mm. Well, no one in my family did this.
Yeah.
Growing up Jewish with parents from another country. And then I had a sister who was
in Overland Park, Kansas. In Overland Park, very Jewish town.
Hugely. It's literally, it's like one giant minion. And having a sister who was born a couple of years after me. I think all of that stuff probably, you know, if set the table for a career in
entertaining people.
Or attention getting.
Yeah.
That's, you know, like trying to get her. I think that is ultimately the genesis of it. I think that I was also, you know, raised with the kind of a very, my parents told me I can do whatever I want, so I can do whatever I want. So I kind of had, you know, a lot of naivete.
Of the best kind.
Of a really good kind, and also a whole ton of luck, you know.
Back to why you like doing theater, why you like doing plays. How is the doing of it, other than you do it night after night after night, different than acting in movies or television?
There's a different feel about it. One of the things that I always liked about doing plays in New York was feeling a part of a community, and it's nice to feel a part of something that is way bigger than you.
Do you drop into the character more than you do making a movie for 2 minute takes?
No.
You're still acting.
Yeah. It's all still just a big lie, but you have to stay in it longer, and there isn't the safety net of, well, if this one just, you know, really isn't good, they're not going to use it.
Right.
If something happens and I don't feel like incorporating it into the scene, I could just be like, all right, you know what, we'll cut and then we'll just do this again.
This isn't live. You could say whatever you want. We'll just do it again.
Oh, I don't want to do it again.
Speaking of the comedy bromance genre, a word I hate, but nevertheless I'm required to use, the seminal one, I guess, is I Love You, Man, which you made a few years ago. I want to play a clip for our listeners who don't remember it or haven't seen it.
I'm really glad you're here, Sydney.
Me too.
I can't even imagine getting married without you. I love you, man.
I love you too, bud.
I love you, dude.
I love you, bro Montana.
I love you, Holmes.
I love you, Brosif Goebbels.
I love you, Machacha.
I love you, Tico Brohe.
Okay. All right.
That is Paul Rudd and Jason Segel in I Love You, Man. I have a feeling that wasn't entirely scripted.
No. A lot of the movie was not entirely scripted. That's another difference, I must say, about, and certainly for the last several years of the movies that I've been able to do, is that there is a lot of freedom to kind of improvise or play around, or just like, let's just shoot it. We know where we need to go with it, but let's make it up. And that's really exciting. And that's something that, you know, you obviously don't do with a play.
Yes. Or get hired again to do a play if you do, I guess. There was a piece about male friendships in the New York Times recently that talked about this movie and your relationship with Jason Segel in it, your character's relationship, in which the author said that he thought no man can really have that, could tell a man that he loves him in that way. What do you think? Is that just him, or is that doable?
Yeah, no, I think that's him. You can't say it in the way that it is in this scene. I disagree. I mean, I've certainly told many of my male friends that I love them. And also,
earnestly, not I love you, bro Montana way?
Well, see, that's just it. I mean, it
you've got to make it funny
to mitigate it in some way. Yeah. I mean, one, it makes it funny, but it's still guys. We're still guys, and you just don't. I don't want to be too earnest.
Yeah.
I don't want to be.
Yeah.
I can't you know, it's different saying it to a guy because it's, you know, you feel different. You love them. But it's, yeah, hey, man, I love you, man. That's what, I mean, that's like, I think it's a great title.
Now, like most of your movie roles, you're a putz in that, but a totally, totally lovable, charming putz. And it seems to me lovable and charming is that's sort of what you do in movies. Do you think of it that way?
No.
No, but you are.
Well, no, I think that the in many of them, and certainly many of them over the last several years, they have been characters that I think people can relate to. They're not,
because we're all putzes.
We're all said. Well, we're all insecure. We're all trying our best, and we all can. Feel awkward at times. I would say there's been a very awkward thread through a lot of the stuff that I've done recently, and that's because that's the way I feel many times throughout, you know, my day. And I think that's not so uncommon.
In This Is 40, speaking of awkward, you play a husband and father coming to terms with middle age in its various ways. I want to play a scene of that film as well.
This sounds horrible, but do you ever wonder what it would be like if you and your wife were separated by something bigger, like death, like her death?
I have given it a fair amount of thought.
Not in any painful way, but just like a gentle floating off.
It's got to be peaceful. I mean, this is the mother of your children.
And then the new wife would be great.
God, I can't wait to meet my second wife. I hope she likes me better than this one.
That's Robert Smigel with Paul Rudd in This Is 40. It's a very funny scene, but also makes one uncomfortable watching it because of its truth, mm-hmm. I suppose.
Yeah.
When your actual wife now asks, so, do you fantasize about me dying? Do you say, no, honey, that was just a character.
there are things in Knocked Up, there are things in this movie that come from my life. You know, and Judd and I, we've worked on these things for a while before we start shooting them, even like in the very initial story idea.
And then he writes a draft and you read and rewrite. Mm-hmm.
And we start talking about like what are some things we can put in it. We spend a lot of time together. He and Leslie and Julie, my wife and I, have sat in rooms for hours.
Leslie being days. His wife,
yes.
who plays
my
your
wife
in the movie.
Yeah. Yes, it's all very
swingy.
It's all one giant key party. I have not had that conversation with my own wife about the fantasy of the spouse dying, but I do remember at the very beginning of this, the idea that Judd had to make this movie, saying, you know, we're having a conversation and saying to him, you know, I have never seen in a movie like somebody talking about this, and I know everyone thinks about this. It's not. It's how can you not? But it's you know, these are pretty raw kind of thoughts. And that was another reason why I like, you know, working with Judd and how we kind of see eye to eye on a lot of things. We want to both tell this story and have it be funny and have there be a lot of laughs. But, you know, at the very essence of it, we were both super interested in, you know, a movie that has about marriage, that has scenes in it that you don't see, that are very real. And, you know, and if you can kind of pull off both sides of it, then maybe it'll be something worthwhile.
You do in this movie.
Well, thanks.
Paul Rudd, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Paul Rudd is starring in Grace on Broadway into the new year. He also stars in the new movie This Is 40, a kind of sort of sequel to Knocked Up that comes out later this month. Good area. Good area. Good to you.
I'll be good to you. I'll be good. We've just wrapped up Studio 360's latest listener extra credit project, the Photo Remix Challenge. The photographers Jerry Yulesman and Maggie Taylor provided some simple photographic elements, and you guys used them to create original works of art. A lot of original works of art. We got more than 600 compositions, some realistic, some surrealistic, almost all of them super interesting, and you can see every one of them at studio360.org. Jerry and Maggie will be back on the show in a couple of weeks to announce the winners. In the meantime, Thanks to all of you for your thousands of hours of creative work. And still ahead this hour, a young man falls for Kurt Vonnegut. Plus, the playwright and screenwriter Richard Nelson uses fiction to cut FDR down to size.
What interests me as a writer is to show people in their complexity and their ambiguities and their confusions. And I think the more we take our leaders and put them on pedestals, the more we take the onus of responsibility off our own shoulders.
The writer behind Hyde Park on Hudson, that's coming up in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion. Scion was started by a small team that was passionate about an idea for a different kind of car company. And now Scion wants to help others follow their passions. The Scion story is at scion.com. Scion, what moves you? And by The Gathering Ireland 2013, a year-long celebration of Irish music, fun, culture, and lots more. For those interested in uncovering their roots, renewing a love of Ireland, or discovering it for the first time. More information at discoverireland.com.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. In the summer of 1939, Europe was months away from World War, and England was desperate for American support. Franklin Roosevelt invited the King and Queen to visit the U.S. and to spend the weekend at his country house in upstate New York. And that weekend, the fate of Europe was decided over a hot dog picnic. Yeah, FDR insisted on serving King George VI hot dogs. The new movie Hyde Park on Hudson, starring Bill Murray as FDR, tells the story of that pivotal weekend. It's narrated by a neighbor of the Roosevelts, Daisy Sukley, played by Laura Linney, who described FDR as her best friend.
Hello?
Who is that?
The president wishes to see me.
I'd been invited to visit with Franklin at his home in Hyde Park.
Daisy? What a rad trip.
His mother said he needed to take his mind off his work and the pressures of being the president.
The playwright Richard Nelson wrote the movie's screenplay, and he says that something more was going on between Daisy and Franklin Roosevelt.
If you look at the diaries, and you look at the intimacy in the diaries and the letters between Daisy and Franklin Roosevelt, and you compound that to the fact that she was one of the three or four people with Roosevelt when he died, that the only two photographs of Franklin Roosevelt in a wheelchair were both taken by Daisy Sukley. And then you put that in the context of Roosevelt's own life and the affairs that we know he had that are well documented and proven.
And figure in this movie as well.
That's exactly right. So when you put that all in the context, I think it's a reasonable assumption to make that they had a loving and intimate relationship.
Given that they are real people and that one of them is, I guess, the most important president of the United States of the 20th century, did you have qualms about making that leap?
I don't. I think that what interests me as a writer, both in the theater and now in film, is to show people in their complexity and leaders in their complexity and the ambiguities and their confusions and how they address that within the events of their lives. And I think that only makes them more human, and I think that makes them more democratic. I think the more we take our leaders and put them on pedestals, the more we take the onus of responsibility off our own shoulders.
These days, these weeks, we are concerned about, or at least interested in, the extramarital affairs of our leaders. In FDR's case, as you researched him and his relationship with Daisy, was there any sense that that relationship had any effect on the way he governed, or had any effect?
Well, I think the question whether it was moral or not to have affairs, I think no. I don't think it had any effect on his presidency whatsoever. I think it had effect on his human be as the human being in terms of relaxing, in terms of trying to organize his life and keep some sanity. I mean, I think what Daisy Sukley provided was someone who he could do just boring things with, go for rides with, sit around and forget with.
And Laura Linney plays Daisy Sukley. Bill Murray is FDR. Let's listen to a clip.
Is my wife behaving herself?
Yes.
Has my mother calmed down?
She's fine.
It's like a madhouse.
Don't worry. All's quiet on the upstairs front. He's definitely younger than I'd imagined. For a king, you know?
Is he?
They both seem nervous. That surprised me.
Without some help from us, Daisy, there soon might not be an England to be king of. So I'd be nervous, too.
Well, it's interesting that you say it helped him relax, be a more a normal person in a way. And one of the things that this movie does, it seems to me, is show even relatively recently, forget the 19th century, that presidents did not occupy such an armor-plated, weird, bubble, Truman Show-like thing, that they could – the real life impinged upon them more easily.
Oh, absolutely. And that's really well put, this Truman Show idea of just complete control. It's who can live in that bubble, and what does that bubble do to a human being? I think when you see the in the film, the relationship, say, between the press and the president and the sense of sort of rules that they had trusting each other and how there are certain boundaries of private life and personal concerns that were not touched on by the press. I think that's a very interesting way of keeping someone in that such a position human.
Bill Murray does a wonderful job as FDR. Was there a risk or did you think about casting such a singular actor, this comic actor whose persona seems nothing like what we imagine FDR's to be?
This was Roger's idea, his first idea, his only idea, I believe.
So the director, Roger Michel, considered no other actors.
He just wanted Bill, and he didn't have to convince me, really based upon that incredible performance of Bill's in Lost in Translation, where there's such a sense of life behind those eyes and also a sense of loss and loneliness and yet a kind of a way of kidding along,
right,
keeping a room easy. All of those things we felt were at the center of our Franklin Roosevelt.
That's interesting.
So it all fit together with Bill. And that's how Roger spent his time trying to convince Bill by pointing out those similarities and those needs.
And Bill Murray doing it as opposed to various actors one could imagine and who have done FDR in the movies instantly allows a viewer, I think, to sort of see this guy as a real human being with sardonic takes on things too, right?
Absolutely. That's absolutely right.
Your Majesty, would you like a hot dog? Do you take mustard?
I take whatever you think I should take with my hot dog.
Allow us then to put on a bit of mustard for you. Yeah. Daisy, would you show how we put on the mustard?
You're too kind.
It's what's this about?
It's very good.
You have written a lot about how important historical moments can play out on a human scale, such as your ongoing play cycle about the Apple family at the Public Theater, which are snapshots of this family, of family members on particular real days, Election Day in 2010, the 10th anniversary of 9/11, then this one last month that took place on Election Day. And each of those plays has opened on the day that they are set. What made you want to do that, opening them on the day?
Well, I think opening on the day just brings the audience into the play. when people are coming on the same day as the play, you've already laid the groundwork for that conversation. There's no leaps you right. have to make. If someone mentions something that's happened just the night before, the audience feels like they are right there. It is being written for them. It is being spoken for them. It is about them. And that's what I've tried so many different tactics, dramaturgical tactics, say, to try to make that happen in the theater. And this is one that's working out very well.
And you write up to opening?
Literally up to the opening. Yeah. I finish the play. I make the promise to the press office that the play is finished by 2:30 on the press night, on the opening night, so that they have time to make copies for the press.
And in the last week or two, is it just a little line here or there, or do you ever do substantial stuff?
Well, this was in the week of.
I guess you didn't know who was going to win the presidency.
Well, this particular play was set in the morning of Election Day,
so you didn't have to.
The characters don't know.
Right.
Even right now, it's still playing, and the characters don't know who's going to win. The audience does. So that's now a very interesting dynamic that goes on. They're watching themselves in the past.
I remember that two weeks ago.
That's right. But in this case, we also had a hurricane. We had a hurricane.
And you refer to Sandy in the play.
Oh, absolutely. People traveled. The characters had traveled to Rhinebeck. So that how did they travel? One character took the train up to Rhinebeck, but the train didn't go to Rhinebeck. The trains were stopped in Croton Harmon. So that various things had to be both addressed and used. There was a very interesting moment when I learned that the day after the opening, there was going to be another storm. There was a nor'easter coming in, and realizing that I could put that into play, and actually it was very useful in a metaphorical sense as well as a very real sense.
A few years ago, you received a big award, and as you were receiving it, you told the audience, "I am arguing for a theater where the mindset is not to fix new plays, but to solve them." What does that mean?
Well, I think that what's happened to younger writers is there's a proliferation of workshops, readings, everyone getting their hand into a young writer's play and telling them how to fix it. The assumption has become that when a play is written,
it's broken.
It's broken already. Exactly. And what I say is, if you look at Hamlet, there's a lot of holes in Hamlet, a lot of big holes in Hamlet. So, but you don't try to fix it. You try to solve it. It's a play to be solved. And that's what I think that's what directors and actors and producers should look at new plays more as animals to be solved. Because the more hands, more fingers into these plays, the less the writer will know what he or she has done. And the less opportunity they'll have to really grow.
That's really interesting as a problem, which I wasn't aware of, because it's well intentioned, of course, but it's turning theater into more of a movie like thing where God knows everybody has their hands in everything, or TV.
Well, exactly. But the problem is, we as playwrights, we own the copyright. We own the work.
Yeah.
So we're not.
That's the edge you playwrights have.
That's it. We're not being hired. We're not being paid to do this work. So we own it, and we should take responsibility for it. We should finish our own work. We shouldn't look to others, because sometimes it's the playwright's fault as well. And we should be treated as people who can achieve and complete their own endeavors.
And I suppose if it's become this epidemic problem, it also entails on the other end not only telling the playwright to solve the problem, but to be more ruthless at the beginning. Like, this just isn't going to work. We're not going to spend any more time messing around with it.
Exactly.
Richard Nelson, thank you very much.
Thank you, Kate.
The movie Hyde Park on Hudson, starring Bill Murray as FDR, opens this weekend. When I was 14, I fell head over heels for Kurt Vonnegut's novels, starting with Cat's Cradle. I loved how he combined science fiction, philosophical wisecracks, and his kind of gentle subversion. And a new collection of Vonnegut's letters that just came out reminded me how important he was to my adolescent writerly ambitions. The writer John Ronson is a decade younger than I am, but he got hooked on Vonnegut at roughly the same age. Ronson writes highly entertaining journalism that investigates weirdness and whack jobs of various flavors, as in his book, The Men Who Stare at Goats. And Kurt Vonnegut's fiction made John Ronson the writer he is.
I started reading Vonnegut when I was 15, 16. I was living in Cardiff and I was just beginning to think about universities. I'd go off on the train around Britain on my own to look at colleges. And I had a bag full of Vonnegut books. I had The Sirens of Titan, Breakfast of Champions, and Slaughterhouse-Five. It's like I was on the cusp of a new life. I was about to kind of leave Cardiff and go out into the world, and Vonnegut was my companion. Slaughterhouse-Five is inspired by his real-life experience. It's about a man called Billy Pilgrim who survives the firebombing of Dresden. And then he goes on the radio, completely apropos of nothing, to announce that he had been kidnapped by aliens and taken to a planet called Tralfamadori. And he swears that he has become unstuck in time. The most important thing I learned on Tralfamadori was that when a person dies, he only appears to die. He is still very much alive in the past. So it is very silly. 1 minute you can be a child, 1 minute you can be dying, 1 minute you can be in the fire storm at Dresden. And so the novel scoots around in time, just like he has learned how to. Now, when I myself hear that somebody is dead, I simply shrug and say what the Tralfamadorians say about dead people, which is, so it goes, and so on. I loved the fact that Vonnegut put himself in his stories as a character. That seemed incredibly daring and original to the 15-year-old me. I love the fact that his sentences are very short and he doesn't try and narcissistically dazzle us with his literary awesomeness. And I love the clash. So he will find humanity and ridiculousness in the midst of the firebombing at Dresden or a family falling apart. So for me, the stark simplicity and the horror clashing with the comedy was just knocked me for six. Because he puts himself in his books and he always portrays himself as quite miserable, I thought, God, I don't want to be a writer if that's your life. You're all alone in a room, chain smoking. That sounds like a terrible life. So it is funny that Vonnegut simultaneously made me want to be a writer and made me not want to be a writer. And then I was offered the chance to work with bands, talented bands, who under my stewardship were failing because I was a terrible manager. So to make ends meet, I started writing for the local listings magazine. So I went into writing really out of circumstance, thinking, God, do I want this terrible life that Kurt Vonnegut writes about? But I did it because it was the only thing I was any good at. Now I write non-fiction adventure stories. Vonnegut has said that it was the trauma of being involved in the Dresden firebombing that, you know, was one of the engines that led him to being a writer, to try and work out the horror through writing. And loath as I am to equate being picked on at school to the levelling of an entire city and its population, I feel the two things are very similar. I don't think the two things are similar. However, similarly, I use writing, I think, as a way to try and work out why people behave in the terrible, crazy, absurd ways that they do. Vonnegut was allowed to sit at home and just imagine it all, but I couldn't do that. I had to go off and actually experience it. So I'd go off to these dark places, asylum for the criminally insane or neo-Nazi compound, and I think try and find some humanity in the sort of dark shadows, I suppose. And I became obsessed with that. I became obsessed with it. I think I still channel Vonnegut. He puts himself into his stories as a character and I put myself into my stories. And the way I write is taken from Vonnegut too. Short sentences, no flowery language. This was a story I wrote. I heard that the world's most sentient robot was so intelligent that she was actually beginning to burst spontaneously into life. A strange thing happens when you interview a robot. You feel an urge to be profound, to ask profound questions. I suppose it's an interspecies thing, although if it is, I wonder why I never try and be profound around my dog. What does electricity mean? When I started writing, I'd find myself using his actual phrases. Where would you go if you had legs? I ask. Vancouver, she says. Why? I say. The explanation is rather complicated. And so on. It's a Vonnegut phrase, and so on. It's kind of embarrassing. I think if I hadn't read Slaughterhouse 5 in that time, maybe I would have become a writer earlier. Because Vonnegut really did convince me not to write. And of course, I then drifted into being a writer. And my life is that. I'd sit alone in a room, an old fart, alone with my memories and my thoughts. And I'm having the miserable life. The only difference is that I quit smoking.
That's the writer John Ronson talking about Kurt Vonnegut. Ronson's new book is called Lost at Sea, and there's a terrific volume of Kurt Vonnegut's letters that just came out as well. Mooj Zadi produced our story with Michelle Siegel. Not long ago, I happened to be talking about Kurt Vonnegut with the great director Mike Nichols and asked him which novel he thought was best. Sirens of Titan, he said, without hesitation. So how about you? What's your favorite of Kurt Vonnegut's works? Tell us at studio360.org. And that's it for today's show. Thank you so much for listening. Studio 360 is a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Vital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Michelle Siegel,
Jenny Lawton,
John Delore,
Sean Ramisferam,
Alana Harper,
Alina Kuczynski,
Matt Leibowitz,
Jesse Taylor.
Thanks as ever to WNYC's Chris Bannon. Our theme music is by David Van Tiegel.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion. Scion was started by a small team that was passionate about an idea for a different kind of car company. And now Scion wants to help others follow their passions. The Scion story is at scion.com. Scion, what moves you? By Ken and Lucy Lehman, who believe that winning workplaces respect, reward, and invest in their employees. By the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. And by the SC Group, whose charitable resources include FJC, a foundation of donor-advised funds at fjc.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360, it's almost impossible to imagine Christmas at this point without Vince Guaraldi.
He just said, I got to play it for you before I forget it. And the song was called Linus and Lucy.
The Peanuts Christmas Masterpiece. Next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
You've been listening to Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson from Public Radio International and WNYC. You can find out more about this episode, access our entire program archive, and leave us a comment at studio360.org.